Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. Most of our programme this time is taken up with an extended interview with John Bradbury, who for many years has been the leader of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra. But before that, we'll be hearing about a bus, which, like the well-known train, and also like the sailing boat that we heard about in our last edition, is called Brighton Belle. Chris English, as I've said before, is keen on many forms of transport, and especially anything that's called Brighton Belle. He's already told us about the Brighton Belle Sailing Club and their yacht, which is based at Brighton Marina, and he's keeping a watching brief on the Brighton Belle train, which is due to come back into service fairly soon. But he actually came across a bus called Brighton Belle, and he couldn't resist the temptation to find out more about it. The bus is owned by Seaford and District Motor Services. So Chris went along to see them and spoke to David Mulpeter, and he began by asking David to tell him a bit about the bus.
Brighton Belle is a 1971 Leyland coach. It was first built as a National Express coach running out of Freshfield Road in Brighton. It was later converted into an executive coach with, as you see, the reclining seats, tables, lighting, and called the Southdown Diplomat. And that was done by Southdown of Victoria Road and their Portslade Works. It lastly then became part of the Brighton Hove fleet. Brighton Hove painted it in the colours you see now, which is the old Brighton Belle colours, as it was a local sort of event, and it was used for corporate and private hire in the Brighton area.
So what sort of thing, I mean, you talk about corporate and private hire, I mean, can anybody hire it?
Anyone can hire the bus. It goes out to that Goodwood Festival of Speed, it was from Derby, birthday parties, weddings, that sort of thing. That's what it gets used for mainly.
And can you have dinner on board? I mean, can you do catering like the Pullman train does?
We don't have any catering yourselves, but you could have your own food or vol-au-vents, that sort of thing, brought on board if you wanted to. Yeah, that's not a problem.
So are there any restrictions at all as to what hires can do?
We don't do a lot of late night hires with them because of the vehicle and high spirits, that sort of thing, but basically anyone can hire the bus from the events. There's no real restrictions other than out late at night.
So tell us a bit about it. Describe the interior of the bus for us.
The interior of the bus is much changed. It's 2+1 seating as opposed to 2+2, so you've got a much wider seat. You've got a lot of foot room because there's only 22 seats and they're all fully reclining seats. You've got a table light, the curtains, toilet at the back, and it's a very, I think, really superb historical executive coach.
Not air conditioned, presumably.
Because no, you've got sliding windows on these. Yeah, if you want the air conditioning, you open the window.
The good old fashioned way. Now notice that this isn't the only historic vehicle you've got here.
No, we have about 14 vintage vehicles. Part of our business is we do a lot of heritage vintage vehicle hire, as well as our mainstream bus and coach operation. And we also do the Eastbourne sightseeing open top buses. So you'll see we've got buses from 1931 up to 2012.
But presumably you can't just buy spare parts off the shelf?
No, we've got a team here that we do manufacture some of our own parts. But yes, surprisingly, with the modern technologies around today, you can get, if you've got a pattern part, you probably can get one made.
So it's not a problem as far as keeping them running?
No, it might take longer than normal. You can't nip down to Halfords and say, I'd like this. It may be, for example, we've got a vehicle, we're waiting for a new clutch in, that's 4 weeks. But it can be done.
What's the attraction of all of us? You're running a business, but you're obviously an enthusiast as well.
I've been interested in transport since I was knee-high. And buses, I always liked vintage buses. I had a bus when I was about 16, and it's sort of grown from there, really, my enthusiasm for it. My personal thing is I like the older vehicles, but the modern day buses pays the wages.
What's the attraction of an old vehicle?
I think it's old heritage. People like to look back in time and heritage, and something's different. All the buses we have here are unique in some way. They're either their only one survivor. We've got two or three here which are unique. They are the only one left. And I think that's what people go for, something's unique. If you have a wedding, people want something different or to be different to everyone else, and that's why they're hiring the buses.
I just heard a bus start up in the background, so they're all operational.
They've got two under restoration behind us, which are for next year, but everything else is up and running and all licensed, ready to go.
I mean, how difficult is it with modern requirements for safety and that sort of thing to keep these vintage vehicles running?
On the safety, they're all inspected. The two types of inspection, there's what we have, a safety service, and we have a safety service plus, which involves a more in-depth one. But basically, they're inspected every 6 weeks. So there's a lot of work goes into inspecting them to keep them going.
And simple things like tyres, presumably you can get those?
Yes, there's no problem getting tyres. Again, there's some more of a lead time. I mean, I can ring up for a modern bus and have a tyre firm down here in 2 hours. With the older ones, there's normally 2 or 3 days. But they're still available.
And you talked about restoration behind us. Uh-huh. There's basically a coach that's just a wooden frame.
Yeah, that's a 1931 Dennis, which is going to full rebuild. The chassis has all been rebuilt, and now the carpenter started on the frame.
How long does that take?
We're hoping for the one behind us, which is the Dennis Falcon, for the 2019 season. The one to the other side of it, the Maudsley, which is a 1931 Maudsley, that should be ready next year for season.
Were they all local to Brighton and Hove and Sussex, or were they from all parts of the country?
The majority are local. The two coaches, the one in the frame you see behind us is a Southdown bus. The one next to it is not from a company in Essex. But most of these are from Southdown, in the Southdown area between Portsmouth and Brighton and Eastbourne.
And if somebody wants to hire one of these buses, how do they go about it?
Either go on the website, this is stephendistrict.co.uk, and there's on our website there's an application form for a hire, and it's got pictures of all the buses, so you can select which one you want, or just give the office a ring, speak to the girls in the office.
And what sort of cost would I be involved in hiring the Brighton Belle?
It's hard to say. It depends on the bill. It depends on how long you've got the vehicle, where you're going to, because fuel and driver's wages. So it could be anything from sort of £300 up to £600, depending on where you want to go for a day hire.
So not a huge fortune.
They're not excessively expensive. I mean, there are some kinds will charge really big money, but we pitch ourselves at what we believe is right, so everyone can enjoy them and have the day out, so they're affordable to everyone.
And finally, the attraction of restoring and working on these vehicles. Is it something in your blood, like it is with steam railway enthusiasts?
Yeah, I'm interested in railways as well. So, but most of the guys here work on them. It's when you see something comes in, like you see the frame behind us, when you see that go out, so you get quite a big buzz of, well, we did that. And that vehicle is restored and saved to everyone to enjoy for the future.
That's lovely. Thank you very much.
No problem.
David Mulpeter of Seaford and District was telling Chris English all about what's that they have in their garage, which is called Brighton Belle. All these vintage buses are available for hire, and you can find out more by going to Seaford and District Motor Services website, which is at Seaford and District, that's typed all as one word with no spaces, .co.uk. That's Seaford and District .co.uk. Or you can phone them on Brighton 510181. That's 01273 510181. Now the rest of our programme is taken up with an extended interview with John Bradbury, who for many years has been the leader of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra. Here's Maya Davis to tell us more.
Well, one of the delights of Brighton in the autumn and winter is the Brighton Philharmonic season. And the audience are always very, very pleased to see familiar figures on the stage. One of those is John Bradbury, who is the leader of the orchestra, and we're very pleased to welcome him today in the studio. John, how long have you actually been leader of the Brighton Philharmonic?
Nice to see you, Maya. Thank you. Well, I used to pop down to Brighton on Sunday mornings 35 years ago to lead under the baton of John Carew. And that was while I was still leading the BBC Concert Orchestra during the week. But after a few years, I became so busy as a freelance that it was necessary to take leave from the Brighton Phil in order to build up connections in London. But I did return, happily, when Barry Wordsworth appointed me officially approximately 26 years ago. So, all in all, half my life, in fact. So I'm almost beginning to get the hang of it.
Yeah. What do you think are the special qualities that you need if you're leading a symphony orchestra?
Well, this is a very big question, Maya, and there are no books or set rules on how to do it, and nobody tells you, because every leader has a different personality and their own unique way of approaching the many aspects of the task. So I can only explain the way I see it after years of trying to get it right. But if you were to ask me for one word to describe my approach, it would be communication.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
I hope so, or I wouldn't be very good as a communicator, would I? So let's talk first about the rehearsals. Now, it's essential that the players see immediately that the leader and conductor are getting along well. Otherwise, personal and musical disagreements can cause instability throughout the whole orchestra. I also try to memorise as many names of the principal players as possible in order to make communication personal and efficient. Although often just a look will suffice, especially if you know that particular player rather well. Then, from the moment I ask the principal oboe for an A at the beginning of the rehearsal for them to tune up, I do try and convey the feeling that we're all here to enjoy making music together in an efficient and professional manner. And then, of course, I do have to show it by example.
So does that continue into the concert?
Yes, the concert is a rather different feel from a rehearsal because, of course, you have the audience there. It's a bit of a different mentality. And the main thing to remember is that I, on stage, am representing the players. So if I look or sound inadequate, the audience is inclined to think, well, if that's the best the leader can do, what about the others? By the time I step out onto the stage, the orchestra will have tuned up, and there'll hopefully be an expectant hush from the audience. I walk out trying to look dignified, yet not overconfident. The temptation is always to rush, but I do resist this, and I take time to smile at the audience before bowing as graciously as possible. Then, of course, I have to turn to get into my seat without losing balance and holding a violin and remembering that my desk partner may not have placed my chair in the right place. That can be quite tricky. Then the conductor appears and all the players stand as a mark of respect. I shake the conductor's hand to show the audience that all is well, and away we go. Then during the concert, I do try to appear as calm and collected as possible, however I'm feeling inside, as this gives confidence to the players and audience alike. If there are any violin solo passages for me to play, I do try and make them sound as if they were written especially for me, although this doesn't always go to plan.
You mean things sometimes go wrong? What happens then?
Yes, it doesn't matter how well you've rehearsed a piece. Little things can go wrong, occasionally badly wrong, not in the Brighton Phil. But if the ensemble does start to fall apart, any good leader will instinctively spring into action to steady the ship by whatever means necessary. But this only works if the players have enough confidence in their leader's abilities. Otherwise, I just enjoy playing the music and try to remember everything the conductor has asked for in the rehearsals.
But there are only 7 or 8 concerts in a year, so that can't be your main source of income, can it? What else do you do?
No, certainly not my main source of income, although one of my main sources of enjoyment, I have to say. On my 40th birthday, I became freelance, which means that my diary service accepts work on my behalf. They know what type of work I'm happy to accept, and I do my best to maintain as high a standard as possible. There are no written contracts.
What? You mean, so what happens then?
Well, with no written contracts, you just have to be there. You have to get it right. And if I get it wrong, I won't be asked again.
And what happens if you're ill? Isn't that a bit scary?
Professional musicians are never ill.
Yeah, right. Okay. I'll believe you.
And if they are, they still turn up.
Well, I remember them flogging through the snow to get there, which was pretty impressive as well. Anyway, what else have you done?
Well, I seem to have covered a huge variety of interesting work. I've been very lucky. I've had many leading engagements for London orchestras, television shows, tours with various artists, lots of symphonic recordings, West End shows and Glyndebourne opera. But as a freelance, I always have to be mindful that you are only as good as your last note. Nowadays, I'm lucky enough to be in demand as a session player, which means my main income is from playing for film soundtrack sessions at Abbey Road Studios or at the beautiful Lyndhurst Studios in Hampstead.
Well, you obviously enjoy working for the Brighton Phil, but apart from that, what do you think are the most memorable things you've done?
Well, many memorable things. The earliest memorable things, and things I'm very proud of, is that I led three orchestras in succession from the tender age of 23. I think I was the youngest BBC leader to be appointed ever at that time. So I started off with the Midland Light Orchestra. I did 3 years with them. Then 7 years with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra under Louis Fremeau, with lots of exciting, passionate French music. Then a job I'd always felt would suit me, the BBC Concert Orchestra in London. And I did 7 years with them, which embraced the light music experience I'd had with the Midland Light Orchestra and the symphonic work I'd done with the Birmingham Orchestra. So I really enjoyed that. Then, of course, along the way, there were radio broadcasts with my wife, Ira, and we had a piano trio that was passed for radio broadcasting. I began writing violin arrangements, which were broadcast when I was leading the BBC Concert Orchestra, and I continued to write arrangements while I directed 10 years of Johann Strauss concerts for Raymond Gubbe Promotions. Then I was delighted to be appointed as founder leader of the RPO Pops Orchestra, which was then conducted by Henry Mancini, and we played from all his wonderful scores, TV music, film music, concert music, and he was a delight to work for. Touring with Shirley Bassey was unpredictable in an exciting sort of way. My first James Bond film session was very thrilling, and I was later to lead for many Bond movies, including all those starring Pierce Brosnan.
Let's go on to something a little bit different. People are always going on about how important the instrument is. And you're a violinist. How important is the quality of the instrument?
It's a very good question, Maya. And it's not very well understood by non-musicians. I think the best way I can illustrate this is telling you the story of Ruggero Ricci, one of the world's most famous solo violinists. He died in 2012 at the ripe old age of 94, and he really was a child genius whose early career centred on his ability to perform all 24 of Paganini's caprices immaculately in one go. But he resolutely denied being a specialist and is credited with the remark, "A specialist is somebody who plays other types of music worse." Of all the fine recordings he made throughout his career, one in particular stands out in relation to your question on the importance of the actual instrument. He filled two sides of an LP with short pieces, and he used a different instrument for each piece. And the sound he produced was, to the listener, exactly the same throughout the whole recording.
So you don't actually need to have a posh, famous Strad?
Well, only if in your mind you feel extra confidence because having such a fine instrument makes you play better. If you really feel that, then owning a Stradivarius would help. But my point is that assuming you are a really good player, and as long as you feel physically comfortable on the instrument, and assuming the violin has a substantial tone over its whole range, then it can be made to work. The personality of the player has a much greater influence over the sound of the instrument than most people realise.
And what about the bow? Doesn't that fit in somewhere?
You would think so. But I think most violinists would agree with me in saying it's not the same for the violin bow, because the differences in weight and flexibility and handling characteristics are so enormous that even top quality bows can be completely unmanageable, however good the player.
So you've got to find the right bow for you, basically.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like fine wine.
Mm. Now, this might be a little bit of a delicate question, given how long you've been playing. Do you still need to practice the violin? I wouldn't have thought so.
Yes, I certainly do still need to practice the violin, but I'm not an obsessive player when it comes to practicing. If there's nothing too difficult on the horizon, I'll happily find other interesting things to do. If, on the other hand, I see something looming that requires attention, I will get on with the preparation as early as possible.
So do you practice every day?
Ah, well, this is a sensitive question. Now, many players feel very guilty if they don't practice every day, but happily, I am not one of them.
Ah, right. Now, you're not exactly under 25 anymore, are you, John?
No, hardly.
Would you say that there are specific problems with playing the violin, or indeed any string instrument, as you get older?
Oh, yes. And after 50 years in music, I've come to realise that the biggest threat to any musician's ability is a gradual waning of enthusiasm. Now, this is understandable, especially as many orchestral musicians feel they are not personally in a position to influence the outcome of any particular performance, or the programme content, or to even consider applying for promotion. But it is very important to keep at least some of the idealistic passion that drove us to take up an instrument in the first place, because a positive attitude will also mitigate much of the physical deterioration that is bound to occur as we get older. So yes, the reactions get slower, the muscles may weaken, concentration can wander, eyesight and hearing usually becomes less acute, but the invaluable fund of experience in how to cope grows in stature with every new day.
So would you say life was harder or easier for older freelance orchestral musicians?
You mean as a player in the profession?
Mm.
Well, unfortunately, human nature tends to assume that up-and-coming young talent will turn out to be better than the existing experienced older talent. But the truth is that symphony orchestras work best when employing a balanced mix of youth and experience. Older players, in my opinion, should guard against shying away from new recruits and vice versa, because each have much to learn from the other.
Well, that sounds like a very good moral precept for approaching orchestral playing. Now, John, a few years ago, you had a year out of playing with the Brighton Philharmonic. You had to have a heart bypass. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you've recovered?
Yes, I'll be pleased to. Well, it's just over 4 years since the operation, and I'm indebted to my doctor, who 6 months previously decided to check up on all the patients he hadn't seen for 3 years. I told him I was feeling short of breath and thought I had a touch of bronchitis. He said nonsense and took it from there. I was sent to Harefield Hospital, who specialise in beating heart surgery, where the heart continues beating and the lungs continue breathing throughout the whole process.
Ooh, yeah.
I know, it sounds awful. But I was in and out of the hospital in the space of 5 days. This was a triple bypass, by the way. After 2 months of recovery period at home, I couldn't wait to get back to work. I'd always worried that after the operation, it might be the time to think about retirement. But my diary service threw me in at the deep end with 4 consecutive days of sessions, working 12 hours on each day. I loved it. Couldn't believe how much I'd missed playing, although it did take me a couple of weeks to get over that effort.
I'm not surprised. Now, another little delicate question. with a violin, you're sitting down all day just playing an instrument, aren't you? Isn't that a bit of a sedentary job? And doesn't it mean you're not always able to keep fit easily?
Well, keeping fit is crucial, I agree. Although there's nothing sedentary about playing a violin on film sessions. If you can imagine, you walk into a studio cram-packed with microphones that are so sensitive that the whole orchestra has to stop in order to turn the pages. If you cough during a take, you'll probably never be asked again. Much of the music is extremely demanding, and your colleagues are the finest, highly experienced musicians available, so you don't exactly slouch in your chair. Then there's the journey to and from the studios. Now, for me, this is a walk to Gerrard's Cross Station. That's only 4 minutes. Often I have to stand on the train for 30 minutes during the journey. Then a walk from Marylebone Station to Baker Street. Not that far, but it is a walk. Clamber up and down the steps in the underground. A 20-minute walk to the studio carrying the violin case. Then, as my heart surgeon pointed out, playing a violin takes a great deal of energy and is especially stimulating for the heart because of the raised arms position.
OK, so physically you're pretty fit. But what about stress? Isn't this a factor even for experienced players?
Yes, this is a huge factor for all professional musicians. Never forget that a professional musician's livelihood depends on how well they play. Younger players have the stress of not knowing much repertoire or whether they're going to make a success of their chosen career, while older players have the stress of wondering how long they'll be able to continue. Raw ambition and naive confidence helps to carry the younger players along, and experience helps older players to weather the storms. But stress management is a major factor in any player's ability to produce their best quality.
Have you ever experienced prejudice against musicians on grounds of age, whether older or younger musicians?
I'll tell you about my first job that I landed, the back of the second fiddles in the BBC Northern Orchestra when I was 21 years old, just left college. And it was common practice in those days for the established members to ignore all newcomers. After 2 months, they were beginning to acknowledge my presence, but by that time, it gave me great pleasure to announce that I was leaving to join the BBC Welsh as sub-leader. Then again, in London at the age of 35, while I was leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, I was offered my first film session. Nothing to do with the BBC Concert Orchestra or the BBC. I couldn't find the studio and I was 5 minutes late. The look of disdain from those older, experienced session players still makes me shudder.
And now you're one of those older, experienced players.
Thank you for pointing that out, Maya. Yes, I am now considered to be one of those older, experienced players. And situations can arise, for instance, where I'm booked to record the music for a TV show, but younger and even more glamorous players are booked to mime in front of the cameras. There are, of course, now many fine young players leaving college who can hold their own in any branch of the profession, and we older ones just have to accept and embrace the situation. There's also prejudice on grounds of gender. When I started out, it was most unusual to see a lady player in any orchestra, with the exception of the harpist. Nowadays, it's quite common for the majority of string players in any orchestra to be young ladies, so the tables have certainly turned on that score.
Would you say that prospects for young orchestral musicians coming out of music college are better or worse now than they were when you started?
Oh, the prospects for joining orchestras now are much worse. In my day, as a student, if we were any standard worth considering, we would assume we would get a job in an orchestra. But too many musicians these days are chasing too few jobs. But there is much more of an enterprising spirit than in my early days. Young players now are very imaginative in their relation to their careers, and they have grasped that modern audiences expect more than a perfect performance. They want to be visually entertained as well.
Yes, and a very good example of that is the new Black and Ethnic Minority Orchestra, Chineke, who've been so successful at the Proms recently. I think that's probably a good advance. What do you think, John?
I'm sure it is. I'm afraid I didn't see or hear that, but I'll look into it.
Mm. Now, let's go on to conductors. They seem to be able to go on producing good work even when they're beyond what most people would consider retirement age. Why do you think that is?
Yes, it is amazing. And they do seem to get better and better. Don't forget that conducting an orchestra is an excellent form of physical exercise. It's also a very good way of keeping the mind sharp. Dealing with the players and the orchestra management, self-promotion, programme planning and lots of hard study can be very fulfilling. And of course, the icing on the cake is the rapturous applause from an adoring audience.
And I'm sure Barry has lots of that.
He certainly does, and quite rightly so.
Now, let's just go back to something a bit more domestic. Your home life, you're married to Ira, who is a pianist. Does your home life have any bearing on your performance standards?
Home life has a huge bearing on any musician's performance standards. We need continual encouragement and constructive criticism from friends and family, a place to relax, a place to practice, to eat well and to sleep well. I find it's essential to have interests and hobbies far removed from music to alleviate the pressures involved in making a decent living.
And what are your main interests and hobbies then?
Oh, well, my interests, here we go. Here's just a few of them. Portrait photography, snooker. I have a little snooker table in our flat in Malvern. Every time I pass it, I have a little go. Love it. Plumbing, electrics, woodwork, brickwork and tiling, architecture, property restoration and my landlord's duties for two apartments in addition to the two that we occupy.
So quite a lot on your plate apart from playing the violin.
Yes, I think it's very important to get away from music and violins, however wonderful they are, and to sort of expand the mind a bit and come back to it all the fresher.
So the next time we see you on stage at the Brighton Philharmonic, John, everybody's going to know that you are not just a person who wanders out with a fiddle. You've got all these other aspects of your life as well. And that in a crisis, you'd be very, very handy changing the washer on the tap.
Oh, I'm very good at that.
Brilliant.
Call me anytime.
Oh, great. I might do that. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Maya.
Maya Davis has been talking to John Bradbury, who for many years has been the leader of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra. The orchestra's next concert is on the afternoon of Sunday, November the 12th, at 2:45 in the Dome. If you'd like to find out more, and indeed find out about the rest of the orchestra's concert season, you can go to their website, which is brightonphil.org.uk. That's Brighton Phil, which is Brighton with P-H-I-L on the end of it, all typed as one word, .org.uk. Or you can call into their offices in George Street in Brighton. I must stress that's George Street, Brighton, not George Street, Hove, from where you can pick up a season brochure. Tickets are available from the Brighton Dome ticket office in Church Street, and you can also get a season brochure from the Dome ticket office. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. It now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part in the programme, to thank you for listening, and until we meet again, to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.